I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I need you to think back with me to the summer of 2003, only a few months after the invasion of Iraq. Remember, the insurgents had just started attacking, and in this country, the debate over the Iraq war, the debate over regime change itself, was the international news story. And yet, while all of us were arguing about Iraq, Eric Reeves was focused on Darfur. He wrote that summer in the Washington Post that, quote, "In the distorting shadow of the Iraq war, this is an exceedingly difficult moment to argue for regime change in Khartoum, but regime change alone can end genocide as the domestic security policy of choice in Sudan." Eric Reeves is not a UN employee or someone with Human Rights Watch or a crisis group. He is an English lit professor from Smith College, but for 6 years, he's made it his business to use his contacts and his computer to keep people's attention focused on the killing in Darfur. He's here this hour. We're going to talk about the difference that one person can make battling a regime that is continents away. And we'd like to hear from you. How do you think activism has changed? Are the protest march and the form letter to the congressman now just wastes of time? How far can one person go in trying to influence a cause? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Eric Reeves is here with me in the studio. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, my understanding of what's happening in Sudan is a lot more limited than yours, but if you got into this 6 years ago, it wasn't Darfur at that time. It was the other war, the North-South Civil War. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Darfur is a conflict that could have been predicted perhaps 6 years ago, but the North-South Civil War, as it's often described, though even a North-South axis is a little bit distorting, was really the event that galvanized my own interest, began my own advocacy career, and launched me as an op-ed writer and an analyst of affairs in Sudan.
There was an encounter with Médecins Sans Frontières that I read about, the Doctors Without Borders head, and who said, okay, Eric, you know, you've been a woodworker for us. You've been turning out these magnificent bowls and selling them and giving the proceeds to Doctors Without Borders. But maybe you could help us do a little bit more. Now, when you said yes to that, were you thinking that you, in fact, would become the activist, or that you'd go looking for someone who could do more?
In fact, the conversation took the following form. Having described Sudan as the most underreported humanitarian crisis in the world in 1998, Doctors Without Borders was in a state of, I won't quite say despair, but this is an organization that prides itself on responding to crises. And at that point, the response of Doctors Without Borders had extended over a full decade. There was a desperate need for a champion. And that's the plea I heard. Sudan needs a champion. I don't know exactly what came over me at that moment, but I said something to the effect, I'll see what I can do. I really don't know what I meant. I didn't at the time. I guess I know now something of what I meant by making that declaration. Sudan is a country that many people, including myself, find strangely compelling. It's almost impossible to see this much suffering and then turn away. Say, well, I've put in my 2 years, or I put in my stint, or I've written my 6 op-eds, so I'm going to go back to being an English professor.
Now, what was your line? I'll see what I can do?
I'll see what I can do.
Now, did you then go off and look for some movie star who you thought you would be able to talk into doing? What were you thinking?
It's a very good question. I've often asked myself that, and I really don't know what I was thinking. It was one of those things you say, you don't know what you mean. It's a statement that is only retrospectively intelligible. I started writing because writing is what I do and I've always done. I started publishing. I found that I could master a new genre, the genre of the op-ed. The op-ed genre is harder than it looks at first. It's one of the reasons a lot of very good people can't get their work published as op-eds. It took me a while to get the knack of it, but I think at this point, having published about 100 of them, I know what it takes to write an op-ed. I know when I've got one. And so that's been a primary way for me to use my rhetorical skills. I also produce very lengthy analyses on a regular basis, running to 5,000 words. These are for a more specialized audience, but they still go very widely. This is something, though, that's developed more recently in my 6-year stint.
The writing of Eric Reeves can be seen on his website. We have a link to it at theconnection.org. We actually have a line through to the capital of Sudan. We were hoping to get a chance to speak to Jonah Fisher, who's a correspondent with the BBC, and we are connected now, I think. Hi, Jonah. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you, yes, just about.
All right. I'll keep my questions short and to the point. What is the latest news there?
Well, the situation in Darfur could be described as the humanitarian situation is largely seen as being contained and under control. The needs of these 2 million displaced people in Darfur are now largely being met by the international community. But in terms of a solution to Darfur's problems, in terms of these people going home, in terms of the instability and the violence which caused them to leave in the first place, in terms of a solution there, there's no end in sight, really.
And what about all the people we don't know about, the ones who are not in refugee camps or displaced persons camps?
Well, that's an assumption to say that there are large amounts of people who aren't in camps, who haven't made it to camps. This crisis has now been going on for 2 years, and for the most part, international agencies can now reach, at some point or other, almost all of Darfur. So there are unlikely to be pockets of large numbers of people. There will obviously be some areas where people haven't been reached, but for the most part, aid agencies have been able to reach most areas of Darfur at one point or the other. So I think it's fair to say that most of what's going on in Darfur, we are hearing about through the UN's people on the ground and through the African Union.
Jonah, two questions for you that are specific in terms of, the first one is a basic reporter's question. We'll be talking later in this hour about the debate over how many people have died in the Darfur crisis. How do you come up with a number when you're writing stories about it?
It's very difficult. There have been a number of different totals given out by various different organizations. It's very tempting to assume the worst. Figures 300,000, 400,000 have been stated. The simple truth is that nobody knows exactly how many. I think people would probably accept that in recent months, people aren't dying in significant numbers because of starvation or them not getting their basic needs. There are still people dying because of violence, but I think everyone accepts that the total per month has decreased in the last few months. So in terms of putting a figure on it, I don't try and put a figure on it. We accept that tens of thousands have died. Everyone would agree to that. Whether it's 70,000, whether it's 160,000, whether it's 180,000, I think Mr. Reeves would probably say 400,000 from what he's been writing. But the simple truth is that nobody really knows.
I'm going to take that up with Eric Reeves after our conversation, Jonah, but at the risk of sort of keeping you too long on the line, one other point for you, and that's again something we'll be discussing this hour on the program. How has the U.S. position been seen to change over there? It was some months back when Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, called what was happening in Darfur genocide. That word has not been used since then. Is that being noticed in Khartoum?
Well, it was certainly very obvious when Robert Zoellick from the State Department came here a couple of weeks ago. Specifically, I asked him at the press conference whether he still considered that genocide was still taking place in Darfur. He avoided the question. He wasn't willing to say that genocide was still going on in Darfur. Some people have interpreted that as being a softening of position from the Americans. Whether that's true or not, we don't really know. But certainly, I think Mr. Zoellick was keen not to get into a semantic discussion about whether it was genocide or whether it wasn't. I think his point was there are just horrific things which have been going on in Darfur and they need to stop.
But if it is a softening of the position, does it matter? Is that softening of the position part of the way that Khartoum is looking at the crisis and the way it's seen around the world?
I don't think Khartoum are putting too much store into this simple word genocide in relation to the United States. When Colin Powell came out and said it last year, it was a very strong statement, which the Khartoum government rejected it. And now the Khartoum government draw great store on the fact that the United Nations Commission, who came here to investigate genocide, decided that it was crimes against humanity, but not genocide. So I think they still regard the United States as having a tough position. Whether they think they've probably come to the conclusion here that the United States isn't going to take direct action. So in that sense, I think they have regarded the U.S. as perhaps stepping back from the hardline position that we saw in the middle of last year.
Jonah, thanks for being with us. It was good to talk to you.
Okay, thank you.
Jonah Fisher joining us there on the line from Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. He's a correspondent with the BBC. We've only about a minute until we have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to talk about this issue of how many people have died in Darfur. It is a big debated point. And I want you to just, if you can, to help us think about it over the break. Why does it matter so much if it's 150,000 or 250 or 350? I'm not saying that the lives themselves don't matter, but how does it change the way we understand it?
Our best way of understanding how many people will still die in Darfur is to understand how many have already died. And if we've seen 400,000 deaths, as I believe we have, it's very likely that before this catastrophe is over, the Rwandan genocide total will have been exceeded.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Eric Reeves has made it his business over the past 6 years to become one of this country's experts on what's going on in Darfur, Sudan. He is under the skin of the politicians. He is provocative in what he writes and what he says. We're going to continue our conversation with him after the break. We'd also like to hear from you. Is this on your radar, or is anything in Africa, anything outside Iraq, simply not making the grade when it comes to the way that you're looking at the international news coming into America? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Eric Reeves is a professor of English literature at Smith College, but he is here in his capacity as one of the most outspoken advocates for keeping this country's attention focused on Darfur. You heard me talking earlier in the program with Jonah Fisher, correspondent for the BBC, who is based in the capital there. He explained how difficult it is trying to figure out how many people may have died in the crisis in the past couple of years, and you will see everything from figures of 60 to 70 to 160,000 people quoted by Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick. The UN uses a figure that's closer to 180,000. The New York Times says as many as 300,000 people have been killed. Eric Reeves, in your latest writing this weekend, you said 400,000, close to?
I think the extant data strongly suggests that 400,000 people have died. And this is the real distinction, I think, between these various estimates, which are based on data and which are simply estimates thrown out there without any epidemiological context, without any research evident behind them. They're just numbers. The UN number of 180,000 came a week after Jan Egeland, UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, said, is it three times the previous figure of 70,000? Is it four times? Is it five times? I don't know. Well, he's just given us a range from 210,000 to 350,000 with no data. The following week, when he issues a figure of 180,000, it's not clear what that's based on, and my queries of his office, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, can't give me a very clear answer as to whether or not it includes violent mortality or not. In other words, is it
people who've died of starvation or people who've been killed by the Janjaweed or in
exactly.
fights, right?
If this is the most basic distinction, since everybody would argue, I think, that the primary, the largest number of deaths have come from violence.
There is a furious debate underway right now involving the State Department and the Washington Post. The Washington Post has been highly critical of the State Department's use of the figures and also spilling over into this other area that I talked with Jonah about. Has the U.S. decided to soft pedal its criticism of Sudan? And if so, why forever in heaven did they do that? Are you watching this same kind of shift?
Yes, I am. And I think it's quite clear that the administration is trying to diminish the nature of the crisis in order to bring about a situation in which they have less pressure on them to respond in ways that are appropriate to a catastrophe on this scale.
You're saying that the less is said about genocide, the less is said about starvation, the less foreign aid needs to go to Sudan? Is it as simple as that?
It's not foreign aid so much. It's the appropriate humanitarian intervention with all necessary military support
okay.
that will protect civilians, will protect humanitarian aid workers, will secure humanitarian corridors, and will bring about an increase in humanitarian capacity. I must say that Jonah Fisher's assessment strikes me as deeply incongruous, given what I see from the UN humanitarian organizations. There's a fundamental lack of capacity, and if we don't increase that before the impending rainy season, hundreds of thousands of people will die.
Rainy season's about a month away, am I right?
The rainy season will start sometime in June and will move slowly northward from West Darfur State, and it will make many villages completely inaccessible. It will create huge cuts in the overland transport routes. It will create what it did last rainy season, what the UN called a logistical nightmare.
Now, you have to help me with this because I have worked in the kind of spot that Jonah is in as a foreign correspondent. And so as I listen to you, I'm thinking to myself, how could you, sitting here in the United States, have a better idea of what's going on over there than Jonah, who's sitting in Khartoum? How would you make that case?
Well, I think actually he's at quite a disadvantage being in Khartoum. He's going to have access to some information I don't have access to. I'm going to have access to a great deal more information that he doesn't have access to as a reporter. Much of this is confidential information coming to me from a variety of government sources, UN sources, humanitarian organization sources. I'm widely known as somebody who can receive information, treat it confidentially, and use it in ways that make it very publicly available.
So if you have someone who is drawing a UN paycheck who doesn't like what the UN is saying, they can talk to you. They can say, I can't use this information, Eric, but you can.
That's exactly what happens all the time. I see a tremendous amount of what we might call disgruntlement.
Where does this come from? I completely understand it. Well, what's with the lowballing? The State Department is playing it down. The UN seems to be playing it down. It's like it's in everybody's interest to say it's nowhere near as bad as we think it might be.
In fact, Kofi Annan published in the New York Times an op-ed 2 weeks ago in which he clearly, without naming me, cited my mortality data. He referred to analysts using a number greater than 300,000. Well,
That's you.
That's me. So I think Kofi Annan is finally finding his voice on Darfur, very belatedly, I will say. But I really don't think it is credible any longer to promulgate a figure of fewer than 300,000 unless you've got the data to show why it is that the extant data I'm pointing to is somehow irrelevant. I'm looking at real data from the Coalition for International Justice, from the World Health Organization, from an epidemiological study published in The Lancet, from all sorts of data on the ground, from the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Food and Agriculture Organization, a host of NGOs, humanitarian organizations within the UN who are giving me data, who have provided data, not to me exclusively, but have put in the public domain data that makes certain kinds of statistical inferences inevitable. If you're not going to make those inferences, you need to explain to me why not. And the State Department document that Robert Zoellick recently had declassified is a scandal precisely because it has no statistics that are cited, because it has no data, because it has nothing but bald assertion. This is not an epidemiological study. This is not a mortality assessment. This is propaganda, finally.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join my conversation this hour. Eric Reeves is here with me. Charlottesville, Virginia. Our first call comes from Nancy. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just saw Hotel Rwanda last week, and listening to this conversation about whether it's genocide and how many people, I'm just humiliated. I mean, so embarrassed to be an American and that we are not helping people because we believe that they are less valuable than Westerners. It's beyond words for me. I just can't even believe that we were having this discussion in the year 2005.
Is it as bad as Nancy described? Nancy, don't go anywhere. I want to bring Eric in here.
I think it certainly is as bad. It is disgraceful that we are watching Rwanda in slow motion unfold before our very eyes. Another reason that mortality statistics are so important, because it does bring into a kind of statistical relationship the catastrophe in Rwanda and the terrible failure of the West to intervene. And now, almost as though the gods of history said, well, we'll give you another chance, another African genocide, and this time we'll make it easier. It'll be in slow motion. And we're still failing. We are still failing. And as Nancy suggests, for some of the worst possible reasons, because the lives being lost are African rather than European.
You don't think it's we're busy with Iraq and the Middle East, we don't have the time and attention span for this?
I do believe if there were a genocide unfolding in the middle of Europe in which 400,000 people were killed and another 400,000 might die before the end of the year, we'd see a very different response.
What do you think, Nancy?
Oh, I agree completely. I see, not to belittle the number of lives lost at 9/11 or the number of lives lost in the tsunami, but that got so much media attention and it was 24/7 on the mm-hmm. news, and here we are again watching all of these people die for whatever reason, be it starvation, be it murder, whatever it is, and we're doing nothing, and we're trying to find a way to rationalize doing
that. One of the reasons why we invited Eric to join us on the program today, Nancy, is because over the past few years, he has made a difference in establishing himself as a voice that both the UN and the State Department, much as they might like to argue otherwise, pay attention to. I'm wondering if in your listening to the program, you think that there's an opportunity for people to say more, to do more today than they might. I'm talking about ordinary people, not necessarily government or UN employees.
Definitely. I'm sitting here. I was listening on my way to run errands in the car with two of my kids in the back seat, and I just am racking my brain. What can we do to help? How can we spread the word? Is it just a matter of putting pressure on our senators to put pressure on the White House? What can we do?
I think those are certainly destinations for letters, and letters rather than emails. I would point out that emails are so easy to send now that they're almost discounted. They're a kind of electronic vote, not really
a communication. But you use the computer all the time, don't you?
Yes, but I would still argue that if you want to make an impact with congressmen especially and
buy
senators, buy a stamp, or better yet, call. If you're a constituent and you call, you will get attention. It's still the case. Or tie up their fax lines. Get their fax number and send a lengthy fax explaining. But an email just goes into a computer that counts them almost automatically and doesn't guarantee that letters will get the right response. But I think more people should be getting these letters. I think the African Union, which has really behaved, I think, quite poorly as the only organization responsible for security in Darfur needs to be put on notice that Americans know, for example, that Nigeria's leadership has been really appalling, that Nigeria has done more than any other African country to prevent an expanded intervening force in Darfur. I think if the Nigerian embassy were to get hundreds of thousands of letters demanding that Nigeria take, as chair of the African Union, a more robust role in seeing to a larger intervening that there was a larger intervening force, this would have a surprisingly large impact on Nigerian thinking.
I'm curious to know, Eric, if you have in any way surprised yourself by where you are and what you're saying and the impact that you have now, if you look back to your first sort of arrival on the scene as a Sudan activist. So
it is at times a peculiar thing to watch one's own effect and say, my goodness, I did that, or I had that effect evidently, or boy, look at all these phone calls that I'm getting. Certainly nothing I predicted, and even 2 years ago I couldn't have said that my career as a Sudan advocate would take the present form it has, if only because Darfur wasn't fully on the radar screen. And I think I was never able to interest college students, for example, in the ways in southern Sudan and an extraordinarily destructive civil war that claimed well over 2 million lives over 21 years and displaced 4 million people or more, created untold human suffering, and had big oil interests right at the center. It seemed natural for college students, and I could never get them interested. In the case of Darfur, it's been just the opposite. Every college campus I go to, I find extraordinary levels of interest. It's one of the most encouraging things about what is otherwise a deeply discouraging situation.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Geetha's with us. Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, that's correct.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I totally agree with the lady that was on before me. I have felt the same way about the Rwanda situation. It's the exact same thing I think America doesn't want to get involved because there isn't any economical interest.
Aren't we, though, all a part of that, Geetha?
Yeah.
Where do you fit? Where do you see yourself fitting then?
Well, you know, when I talk about trying to get involved in things that promote social justice and humanitarian things that I want to do for other people, and I speak about these things to other people, there's such a big indifference. You know, it's out of sight, out of mind. And
is it an indifference based on the idea that one person can't make a difference, or that just nobody's listening anymore?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, and like the lady before me, I want to do something. What can I do? What can I do? When I talk to someone, I spoke to someone this morning about getting involved, and it was like you're only one person. What can you do? You can't change anything, and it's very discouraging. It's really discouraging, and I thought until he said that the college kids were interested in getting involved, mm-hmm. that nobody really cared.
I want to ask Eric if there's a personal way of helping explain this, because you made that decision some 6 years ago to say, okay, I'm going to give this a try. But was there a point a year into that or 2 years into that when you thought, and it's working, or, you know, it's not just good for me, my own conscience, my sense of engagement, but I'm having an effect. How long ago did that happen?
Well, it certainly came in stages. I published a lot in the summer of 1999, especially around oil development in southern Sudan. And this really created a kind of visibility to the catastrophe that it not had. I published a piece in the Globe and Mail, Canada's
Talisman,
the Canadian oil company. Yeah. I published a piece in the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's New York Times, its newspaper of record, and called Genocidal Oil Fueling Destruction in Sudan. And I was told by a contact in the foreign ministry that it hit like a ton of bricks within the foreign ministry, that suddenly something that had been largely invisible was made very, very visible. I published another op-ed in the Los Angeles Times calling for a divestment campaign against Talisman. Within 2.5 years, the company had been forced to exit Sudan with its tail between its legs and selling the...
They waited 2.5. They argued against it for over 2 years.
They did, but they took a terrible beating in the stock market as well. Their share price was down by 30 to 35% at one point.
I just ask you to pause for half a sec, because Geetha's still with us on the line, and I'm wondering, as you describe this, are you saying that you need that kind of, you know, college professor's writing skill to have that impact?
No. For example, right now there are a number of state legislatures that are considering a new divestment campaign, and particularly divestment legislation. We will see very shortly in the state of Illinois a law which obliges all Illinois' pension funds to divest from all companies supporting the genocidal Khartoum regime. Now, get it started in your state. If your state's state legislature doesn't have pending legislation demanding that all state pension funds divest from shares of companies that are doing business as usual with a genocidal regime, that's something anybody can start. State legislatures are very approachable. They're not highfalutin typically, and they're not remote. And they want to hear from constituents.
What do you think, Geetha?
I'll give it a shot.
And there's
thank you.
All right. Thank you for being with us. And, you know, for more information about this, we're going to have a number of links on our website at theconnection.org. They'll include a link to yours, Eric. But are there other links are there a range of links that you would also recommend? I mean, we can put them on later. But
well, there are now a surprising number of Darfur related websites. I would go to a Google search and put in Darfur, put in divestment, put in other elements of the Darfur crisis you wish to learn about, but the Google search engine is a magical device. It's one of those features of electronic communication that fascinate me as I think about political and moral advocacy in the age of electronic communication.
Even I can do that. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK to join my conversation this hour with Eric Reeves. We're talking about what's going on in Darfur, this country's response, this country's lack of response, and how it is you can, in fact, function as an activist who gets heard today. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Eric Reeves is here with me in the studio. He is, according to his business card, a professor of English literature at Smith College, but more people will know him for his advocacy in Sudan, first with the civil war and now with the crisis in Darfur. He's here to talk about his own decision to become an activist, how that works, or if it works. Today, 1-800-423-TALK to join us. Let's go to Cambridge for our next call. Scott's on the line. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am presently a visiting professor of English at the University of Massachusetts here in Boston, and am teaching this semester a course called Literature and Genocide. And in fact, just yesterday, a group of students gave a collaborative presentation on the history of Sudan and Darfur. And I wanted to ask Professor Reeves, there seems to be a supposition that really animates my class that what we're doing in the classroom is not in itself a form of activism. There is a tension between the sort of intellectual engagement we have in the classroom and anything that might take place outside of the classroom. And I'm wondering if you could just speak to this concern. I very much want to make the classroom a space for that sort of activist potential, but the students seem to think that reading books and writing about these events and the historical conflict, these are not in themselves forms of activism.
You mean if it's homework, it doesn't count?
In a sense, yeah. If it's taking place within the, you know, the sort of institutionalized and sanctioned space of a classroom, it's not counting in some way.
Actually, I think this is a difficult question. To what degree should classrooms be a venue for what some would call political activism, others would call basic humanity? I myself, though I have worked on Sudan very, very intensely for a long time now, have taught many classes in which my students have no idea that my work on Sudan is as big a part of my life as it is. Now, these are classes on Milton and Shakespeare, so there's not much of a segue opportunity. But I think you're up against a difficult question. To what degree is your job one of actually producing politically measurable results, or, on the other hand, to produce those informed citizens, students, who will inevitably, in the real world, knowing what they know by virtue of what they have learned in your class, respond to genocide, not in the class, but by virtue of what's learned in the class? I don't know how to sort out that question, but it seems to me a live question, one that any teacher is going to need to confront in the situation you describe, especially in a course, Literature and Genocide. Many literature courses are not going to have the same kind of opportunity, but yours is one in which that question, it seems to me, is challenging and a real pedagogic, perhaps, dilemma.
Do you get the sense that the question suggests a larger lapse, perhaps, in the sense that the academy is there to really train more active participants in a democratic citizenry?
Well, even that characterization of the academy would be challenged by many within the academy. And the fragile and tenuous consensus that allows us to speak of the academy is something that I would suggest can't be settled in a sentence, can't be settled in a series of stipulations, that it's an ongoing debate, that the relationship between the academy as part of the world and the academy as a place that is usefully removed in some ways from the world is going to be a challenging discussion forever, I think. I don't see any way I can give you the guidance here that perhaps
I find,
we all...
Scott, it's Dick here. I find that my own daughters, when they study these things in college classes, then tend to read the newspaper article that takes that understanding a little bit further. If it's only just the ability to say, hey, I think I understand this story, that's the connection that I see as a father. Do you see any of that, Scott?
I do, and that's my sense that, you know, that's the real work that can take place in a classroom, in any classroom, but especially a classroom like Literature and Genocide. That I've noticed, especially this semester, and I teach a lot of courses, my work is in especially the First and Second World Wars, so I'm constantly coming up against issues like this, but especially in this class, my sense is that the students want the classroom to count in different ways and to affect different sorts of transformations in their lives.
Well, we're actually going to swing along to a college student who's joining us on the line. So, Scott, I'll thank you for your call. Go next to Iowa City, Iowa. Jonathan's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. I love your show. My question, I have two questions. One about Darfur. Just as far as that's concerned, what is the role that the U.S. government and the U.N. are taking in regards to the International Criminal Court? And how much is the ICC playing a role in present investigations of the genocide there? And
hang on, Jonathan. Let's deal with that one. Then I've got a question for you. Eric, okay. Can you help Jonathan on that one?
That's a very good question and an important issue. Security Council Resolution 1593 refers all violations of international law committed in Darfur to the International Criminal Court. The United States, in the event, abstained in the vote that allowed this referral to go forward. Thus, we have a list of 51 names under sealed indictment going to the International Criminal Court. This is the first big case for the ICC. And though the Bush administration is adamantly opposed to the ICC, allowing it to go forward, I think was a necessary compromise and a wise one. And I think we're going to see a very, very interesting effort at international justice. That said, the claims by human rights groups that this is going to provide a deterrent effect on the ground in Darfur is wholly misplaced. In fact, the evidence I'm getting from a variety of highly reliable sources, including on-the-ground sources, suggests that just the opposite is true, that Khartoum's response is, first of all, to say we will never extradite people who, after all, run the country to The Hague for trial, and secondly, that just to emphasize the point and to intimidate those who might think of taking more robust actions, Westerners, non-Sudanese humanitarian aid workers will be targeted. And we've seen a very sharp uptick in violence directed against aid workers and threats against aid workers. Many, many roads are closed to overland transport of critical food and non-food items.
So how does it add up at the end? Does it add up at the end that the International Criminal Court threat of indictments is actually doing more to harm the people under risk in Darfur than help them?
I think we need to look at it in the broader historical context. I think we need to say down the road, genocidaires, those who would commit genocide in the future, are going to see that eventually the International Criminal Court was able to hold these men accountable. May take years,
right?
But that fact will be historically important and will have a deterrent effect in the future. But right now on the ground, it has only angered Khartoum, only provided incentive for them to direct the Janjaweed to be more aggressive in targeting Western and other aid groups.
Jonathan, back to you. Just if you can, to pick up the part of the conversation we were having with the prof here, with Scott, on how students make a connection between what they see in the classroom and what interests them, what causes they want to get behind. Do you have any advice for him?
Well, I'm not really sure. I tell you, the hardest thing for me is keeping all my friends and all the other college students that I associate with interested on one issue. My campus is very active, but it's got a very short attention span. So when Hotel Rwanda came out and Don Cheadle was out talking about Darfur, everybody cared, but a month later, nobody talked about it. And I guess I was curious, more or less, to know how do you keep people, especially college students, focused on like one issue long enough for it to matter.
Well, the compelling nature of the Darfur crisis, it seems to me, gives you a real advantage here. This is a genocide that is not going to stop because we reach the end of the month or the end of the school year. People are going to continue to die. Hundreds of thousands, I believe, will die over the course of coming years because of the genocidal actions to date. But I think there are other things that can be done long term. Ask yourself, is your state legislature considering divestment legislation, legislation that would require public monies invested in companies doing business in Sudan to withdraw those investments? Does your university or college endowment invest in these companies actively supporting a regime actively engaged in genocide? Start a letter-writing campaign focusing on the Nigerian embassy. Really go after your local congressman with a whole series of phone calls to his office or her office, making clear that you're just not going to stop calling until you get an adequate response to whether or not this congressman supports the Darfur Accountability Act, which is at a critical juncture right now.
But Jonathan, I don't want you still got to study for your math exam, okay? 1-800-423-8255 to Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quinnell's with us. Hi, Quinnell.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm calling because I have seen Eric Reeves speak at Smith College. I was lucky enough to be in Massachusetts at the time. I'm really from Indiana. I've called because I have gone to see the drawings of the children of Darfur that was also shown here in Massachusetts. And I picked up a Genocide Intervention Fund 100 Days of Action organizing kit packet that was given out at the drawings of Darfur children mm-hmm. by the, and I think it's put out by the Swarthmore College.
Yeah, Eric's nodding. Did you have a question about it, Quinnell?
I had a question. Well, I was making a comment because you were asking what college students can do. I also called because I heard on the Democracy Now! Program this morning
yep.
that I'm going to look for his name. Ken Silverstein of the LA Times put out a report this morning that the U.S. and Sudanese
Oh, I know the one you're talking about, where they're in talks over terrorism, so do they, and I think that the head of Sudanese intelligence, in fact, came to Washington as a part of that. How much do those talks have to do with the UN keeping, or the U.S. keeping its mouth shut about what's going on in Sudan?
A very interesting question. Saleh Ghosh, Major General Saleh Ghosh, who is head of security and intelligence for the National Islamic Front regime in Khartoum, an extraordinarily brutal and crafty man, and who was Osama bin Laden's handler when bin Laden was in Sudan from 1991 to 1996, was flown on an executive jet from Khartoum to Washington the week of April 18th to 22nd.
Now, this past month?
Yes.
Okay.
What is significant is that came just 3 days after Robert Zoellick refused to answer the question, is genocide being committed right now? So here we... Zoellick certainly knew that Saleh Ghosh was being flown on executive jet to Washington and that the issue would be what intelligence will the Khartoum regime provide to the United States. I would not dissociate the two things, the refusal to characterize this as genocide while right. in Khartoum and his knowledge that Saleh Ghosh would be flown to Washington for presumably a very important briefing on what Khartoum knows about international terrorism. It should also be emphasize that while we don't know the names under indictment at the International Criminal Court, we know there are 51 names. We know that the Commission of Inquiry put together by the United Nations has indicated that a number of them are high-ranking government officials. And there's absolutely no way, given Saleh Ghosh's role in genocide in Darfur, that he is not on that list of 51. So we have invited a known genocidaire to Washington on an executive jet at the very moment we, the United States, Robert Zoellick, Deputy Secretary of State, refuse to characterize this as genocide. This is much more than an issue in semantics, as an earlier news report in the hour suggested. This is something that goes right to the heart of the Bush administration perception of what it will and won't do for Darfur.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Eric, is I have a file folder here where I printed off op-eds and I printed off Nick Kristof in the New York Times today and letters to the editor from the Washington Post. And it occurred to me when Jonathan was talking from Iowa City, you know, like, what do I do to keep people motivated here? All that stuff is from page 4 or 5 or 6 or 7. There isn't a lot of daily coverage of what's going on in Darfur. And I would say from earlier programs, you can correct me on this, that a lot of it has to do with it's a tough story to cover. It's tough to get in there. It's tough to work there. It's both dangerous and inaccessible. Is that a part of what we're talking about when we're talking about the difficulty of keeping people's attention focused?
It's a huge part of it. Khartoum has cracked down very, very severely on the number of visas and travel permits it will give. It's clearly in a phase where it is trying to do as much as it can to prevent firsthand knowledge of the situation from coming out either through news reporters or human rights groups, which are also finding it almost impossible to get visas. And this is a difficult story to make compelling in a new way. There's a kind of remorseless, grinded out familiarity to famine conditions prevail. Children are dying. The camps are appalling. Half the people in the camps have no access to clean water. The water situation is very bad.
The rainy season is upon us. It's not like we haven't heard all this before. I think you're quite right.
We have heard all this before, and we're going to hear it again. And the remorselessness of it and the repetitiveness of it is something which it seems to me is the job of a journalist to overcome. And there have been some very good journalists reporting on what's happening in Darfur, but few of them really can sustain the kind of attention that it seems to me is warranted by the scale of human suffering and destruction.
So still, we come back to something's missing. Something, if, as you say, we're looking at Rwanda in slow motion, where are the two dots or the connection between those two dots, and why isn't it just clear as a laser to us?
I don't know. It can't be because we don't know. We know far too much. Maybe we don't have the horrific scenes of bodies floating down the river through Kigali, but we have plenty of images. We have plenty of knowledge. We have an ample amount of mortality data. Why this isn't more compelling is ultimately, in some ways, a moral question. It's a political question, but it's also a moral question. And in that sense, it's a question for every listener here today to ask and answer for himself, herself. Why am I not doing more? What was I doing during Rwanda? What would I have done had I had more time, more power, more scope for action? Well, that question is being forced on you today by virtue of what we know of Darfur.
And too simple to say, well, the president's dropping the ball on this, so the U.S. is dropping the ball. You're saying make it personal. You're saying think about it in personal terms if you want to think about it seriously.
And make the Europeans step up to the plate. The Europeans are far, far behind even the United States. I think the Europeans have done not nearly enough in bringing pressure to bear on the African Union, have not done nearly enough in making clear that without humanitarian intervention, hundreds of thousands of lives will be lost. It's as clear as that. That's the laser clarity that we need to cleave to.
I thank you so much for coming in. It's nice to have you here.
My pleasure.
Eric Reeves' website and other resources about Darfur can be found at our website, wearetheconnection.org. Eric Reeves is a Darfur activist and a professor of English literature at Smith College. We also talked briefly with Jonah Fisher, BBC correspondent, based in Khartoum, Sudan, at the beginning of the program. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.